It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Madison-based diagnostics company Exact Sciences announced yesterday that it is being acquired by the Illinois-based pharmaceutical giant Abbott Laboratories. The value of the deal is estimated to be $21 million, and Exact Sciences is best known for Cologuard, the screening test for colorectal cancer.
The $21 billion move still has to be approved by shareholders and industry regulators, but Abbott CEO Robert Ford told investors that it represents the largest transaction in healthcare in the last 2 years.
We're checking in on what the deal means for the thousands of Exact Sciences employees and its labs in Madison.
Peter Loftus is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal covering the pharmaceutical and medical device industries. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, in the context of the Wisconsin business world, a $21 billion deal is a big deal. How about in the world of pharmaceutical and life sciences industries? How does this stack up compared to other deals in the last few years?
Well, yeah, I think even by world standards, it's a pretty big deal. We have seen in pharma and med tech deals valued over $10 billion or so in the last couple of years. But certainly this would be one of the biggest, and it would be Abbott Labs' biggest in about 10 years when I think they made a $25 billion acquisition. So it's a pretty big deal.
Exact Sciences has Cologuard, which is probably their best known product. What is Abbott looking to get into by taking over purchasing this Madison company?
Well, so Abbott's a pretty big company. As you mentioned, they make pharmaceuticals, primarily generics overseas. But they have a whole range of businesses, and it includes things like heart devices and diabetes glucose monitors, these wearable monitors. So they've also long had a diagnostics business. It's been more traditional types of diagnostics. And this includes the Binex Now COVID test, the at-home COVID test that I think a lot of people would probably recognize. But they've, with the pandemic fading and in the past, really, the demand for that COVID test has faded. And so the diagnostics business for Abbott has actually been, kind of flat to down. And so, and they really haven't been involved in these types of diagnostics and screening tools that Exact Sciences has. And so for Abbott, this is a way to get into that business that they see as a big growth business in the years ahead.
Recently, Exact Sciences announced a new multi-cancer screening blood test to add to its successful single cancer test. It's still got a ways to go in the approval process. We talked last month with the company's chief medical officer of multi-cancer early detection. Here's a listen to Dr. Tom Baer.
We see a future where those single cancer tests will continue to play a critical role, but we'll also be able to get an annual blood test that will enable us to screen for many more cancers and improve how we protect ourselves against the risk of cancer.
Is having that product, that kind of product in the pipeline, Peter, an incentive for a company like Abbott to take a close look at Exact Sciences?
Yeah, I think that's a big deal. I mean, as you've already mentioned, Cologuard is something that's on the market. It's out there, and that has appeal. But this potential future line of business of these multi-cancer detection tests and through a blood sample, that's really considered kind of a holy grail. In fact, there is a company called Grail that makes one of these. And it's a competitive business. There's a lot of startups that are trying for this. Something where, perhaps once a year you could give a blood sample and it could tell you with some degree of accuracy that you might have or might be likely to have one of many different kinds of cancers. And so that's something that I think analysts who follow the industry see as a market that could be, in the multiples of tens of billions of dollars at some point in the future.
Pharma and life sciences, it's a unique kind of business. If I invent a new toy, well, maybe I can have that on the shelves in a couple months. If I invent a new cancer screening, it's a multi-year process, right, to get it tested and FDA approval and things like that. this is kind of a gamble in some ways for Abbott, isn't it? Do people see this as too large an amount for products that may ultimately never be approved?
Well, you make a really good point, and I think it's something that people who follow this industry maybe start to take for granted. But yeah, I mean, these development times can be years and years, and in some cases decades. And so it is a gamble because you have to kind of put up all this money up front into the expensive research and development, and because a product often depends on some sort of regulatory action or even coverage by, say, Medicare or other insurers, and you don't know for sure if that's going to happen, it's a bit of a gamble. And so I think that's been one of the concerns and issues with this particular market, these multi-cancer early detection tests, because, there have been instances where there's been some questions about the value of them, or the value, say, of whether to cover them, if you're a health insurance plan, that sort of thing. And so that's sort of one of the issues that's kind of hung over this industry.
We're talking about Abbott Labs of Illinois acquiring the Madison-based company Exact Sciences. Wall Street Journal pharmaceutical reporter Peter Loftus is with us. A lot of people work for Exact Sciences in Wisconsin, Peter, and a lot of times, well, if my company has been bought out by another company, does that mean layoffs? What are people looking at for what part of that workforce might stay on the job? What kind of changes might be made?
Yeah, I think Exact has about 6,500 to 7,000 employees, and some analysts yesterday did sort of speculate that the deal could involve some synergies, which is a sort of an unfortunate Wall Street term for savings that often come in the form of layoffs, or at least not growing staff. But it was. Some of the commentary was more limited to, say, the sales force. So, Abbott has a sales force that promotes some of its products to primary care doctors, and Exact Sciences has a primary care sales force. So there might be some overlap there. But I will say that the CEO of Abbott yesterday, he did not really emphasize this, savings as a rationale for doing the deal. He was more just talking about the growth potential. And so I don't think he got into specifics, but I think that might be one indication that this might not involve, just massive layoffs, but we don't know for sure yet.
Yeah. And both parties, it seems like Exact Sciences and Abbott, seem to be emphasizing there will continue to be a Wisconsin presence for this company. The current chief executive is going to remain with the company. This is not going to be, they're not going to up stakes and pull everything down across the border into Illinois, if I'm reading their announcements right.
Yeah. I mean, and I think I have to think that the infrastructure there and what Exact Sciences has built up with something that's so technical and involves a lot of proprietary know-how, I'm not sure how easily transferable that could be, where they could just move everything, to another city or something like that.
The deal still needs some approvals. The shareholders, regulators, what kind of steps need to happen now to take this announcement and have it be done? And then this is one company we're talking about.
Well, normally, deals of a certain size have to undergo antitrust scrutiny. I don't believe that will really be an mm-hmm. issue for this, because Abbott, it's not like Abbott has its own products and businesses that are really competing with Exact Sciences. This is more about getting into a new space. But again, there's no guarantee. And so if it does pass antitrust scrutiny and just other necessary regulatory and shareholder approvals, I think they're looking at sometime in the second quarter of next year, the deal closing.
Peter, I want to get your outsider take on this industry here in Wisconsin. There's a long history of spinoffs from the UW, things like discoveries of vitamins and Coumadin, the vital heart medication, and thoughts that, hey, this part of Wisconsin could be sort of the Silicon Valley of biosciences. looking at this from outside of Wisconsin's borders, how big a player is Wisconsin's biotech industry in the wider world?
Well, certainly it sounds like it has potential. I mean, I think the real hubs continue to be in places like Boston and San Francisco and maybe a couple other West Coast locations, to some extent, Philadelphia. But certainly, you know, with assets like, you know, research universities, I think there's always that potential. So I think, you know, there's no reason to think that can't continue.
Now, in the industry, Abbott takes over Exact Sciences. Do Abbott's competitors say, hey, we need to acquire a startup or a smaller company that's doing similar stuff to stay competitive? Does a deal like this trigger a domino effect with more deals like this?
I think there is that potential. I mean, I think this was the first deal that involved a big company coming in and getting this particular type of company. But yeah, I mean, there's others out there like Guardant Health, other you know, small to mid-sized companies that I think you know, certainly have that potential. That because this is seen as a big and growing market over time, that might be attractive to a large company.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Peter Loftus, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covering the pharmaceutical and medical device industries. He was with us today to talk about the impact of Abbott Laboratories acquiring the Madison-based diagnostics company Exact Sciences. Well, is this a story about you? Do you work for Exact Sciences? Are you wondering what this is going to mean for your career? Or do you work in the wider biotech, health, life sciences industry in Wisconsin? What's going on? What are you watching for? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, 20 Wisconsin school districts get federal funding called Impact Aid because they serve federal or tribal land that doesn't pay property tax. The funding has been delayed this year. We check in with leaders at two of those districts.
So if we weren't to have Impact Aid, if for some reason we didn't get it, I mean, our doors would be closing, you know, within the year.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A number of school districts are still waiting on federal aid that was delayed because of the government shutdown, with some districts potentially going into debt to make payroll.
The Federal Department of Education distributes funding through a program called Impact Aid. That money reimburses school districts for lost property tax revenue if they have non-taxable land in their districts, things like federal land or tribal land.
20 districts here in Wisconsin receive this funding. Some of them get millions of dollars annually because they serve large areas of tribal land.
Impact Aid was expected to arrive in mid-October, but the federal government shutdown put those payments on pause. And even in years without a shutdown, the timing of this funding can be unpredictable.
The districts serve more than 20,000 children in the state, according to estimates from Governor Evers. Evers called for the funds to be released earlier this month.
We'll hear now from two districts that rely on that funding. Beth Papp is district administrator for the school district of Bayfield, and Josh Ernst is superintendent of the Lac de Flambeau School District and is the Wisconsin chair for the National Association of Federally Impacted Schools. I talked to them earlier this week. Josh, can you start us off by telling us about the intent of this Impact Aid program? What is it supposed to be doing for schools? What kind of schools tend to be eligible for this?
So it's all school districts that are on non-taxable land. So your Indian reservations and then also your military bases. It's money that can be used for your general operating budget. So it really is money that keeps your doors open, your heat running, kind of your basic budget spending.
I want to get a sense of the geography for both of your districts. Beth, can you talk about the service area in Bayfield and what kind of land is making you eligible for this impact aid?
Sure. Our district is unique in that we have mainland and island land that is part of our district. What impact aid is and how it's connected with us is that a large portion of our district is part of the Red Cliff Reservation. And that is non-taxable land, which falls under the auspices of the whole intention of impact aid.
And Beth, Josh mentioned that, you know, this is general purpose funding, a lot of it. What do you rely on this impact aid funding for in Bayfield?
It's a large umbrella. Part of the beauty of impact aid dollars for public schools is that we are committed to using those dollars to assist in the education of our Native American students. And so I'm echoing what Josh shared, that these funds are used to help with programming, with utilities, with supplies, maintenance. You name it, we're able to access and use at our discretion those impact aid dollars.
And Josh, tell us a little bit about the Lac de Flambeau School District and how impact aid fits in there.
Yeah, so we have about 500 students. So I think we're at 515 students, and we're 99% Native population on the Lac de Flambeau Reservation. So for us, like, impact aid dollars is really our lifeline. I mean, it's almost 40% of our overall budget. So if we weren't to have impact aid, for some reason we didn't get it, I mean, our doors would be closing, within the year. It's a large percentage of our budget. And, you know, we lobby to legislators every year. It is a bipartisan issue. So it's should be on both sides of the political aisle, should be supporting, you know, the funding. But unfortunately, I don't believe impact aid has been 100% funded since like 1960, I think the late 60s, early 70s. So it really, it started in 1969 and it's never been fully funded. So we always lobby to have it fully funded. So again, it's not only like keeping our doors open. I mean, it's 40% of our budget. You're talking about instructional materials, salaries, transportation, technology, heating, you know, all of that. So it really is keeping our building open.
Well, never fully funded, but now we've got the shutdown and shakeups at the Federal Department of Education. I understand impact aid funding was supposed to arrive, Beth, in the middle of October. As of now, when we're talking, I think it still hasn't. What has been the timeline of you finding out that, hey, this money that you'd been, I assume, budgeting and expecting wasn't showing up, at least not on schedule?
It's been a frustrating wait-and-see process where, given the shutdown, it has thrown a monkey wrench in how we're moving forward with budget allocation for this fiscal year, for sure. We aren't receiving any inside scoop information from impact aid funding sources. So that's been frustrating for us. You know, we're hearing information about the same as the general public is getting news blasts out from Washington as well. We always yearly put in for that early allocation of funds, which typically comes around the middle of October. And here we are nearly to December, and we don't have any new information beyond what the general public is receiving.
And Josh, we're having the same issue here. Some of our reporters are trying to track this and running into similar results, not getting a lot of information. You, Josh, are Wisconsin chair from the National Association of Federally Impacted Schools. Is this across the board? Nobody knows exactly what's going on with this impact aid funding right now?
Yeah, nobody knows when the installments are coming. I echo that, you know, that we do. You typically get our first installment in October. There's typically three installments. But I don't see it that different than in years past, because we don't ever really know, you know, when we're going to get our impact money, or how much money we're going to get, or how many installments we're going to get. You know, last year, there wasn't a shutdown, obviously, and I don't think we received our first installment until December. So one positive thing that I can, like I see from all of this, is I feel like it's bringing more awareness to impact aid. And it's challenging to budget a district when you don't know when your installments are coming. You don't know how much money you're going to receive. I mean, you can do your best guess. I mean, that's every year that we're dealing with this.
So wait, I want to make this clear. So I'm a school district administrator. I'm opening up the doors in the fall. I don't know when and how much money is going to be coming for the program for this school year I'm opening up the doors for right now?
Yeah, each year that's what all districts that receive impact aid deal with on an annual basis. You know, so it is really challenging to, you know, build your budget based off of, you know, your best guess, 3-year average, 5-year average, whatever you choose to do internally. But we don't know how much money we're going to get until we receive it, and then we don't know when it's coming. Like, it typically does come in October, but not every year. It doesn't come every year in October. Like I said, last year I think we received it in December. One year we got it in 2 installments. Another year we got it in 5 installments. But the hope is that it's 3 installments and it starts in October.
I got to ask, Beth, how do you manage that? You have real bills, right? Heating bills and salaries to pay. And I guess hypothetical money to pay with it. How do you juggle that? How do you manage that uncertainty, even in a normal non-shutdown year?
Carefully. It is certainly a frustrating reality, and I wish that we had greater capacity to be able to bring awareness to how difficult it is for districts that do rely on impact aid, that have the privilege, I would say, of receiving impact aid, because that means that we get to engage with and work with the students and families who live on those non-tax lands. As Josh mentioned, in our case, it's tribal land or military base type land. It's difficult for budgeting. I'm not going to say that it's easy. And we really have to have flexibility. And even in the past years, we have, while we wait for our other property tax dollars to come in, we have suspended any spending of you know, teacher supplies. Maybe field trips are put on hold. So we really do have to impact education of our children as we wait for these funds to come in. And I'll second what Josh said too, which is, we don't have a calendar and know when the funds will arrive. And it has yet to be 100% of what we should be receiving.
We are talking to 2 school district administrators, Beth Papp from the Bayfield School District, Josh Ernst from the Lac du Flambeau School District, talking about federal impact aid for schools in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country that have a lot of non-taxable, non-property taxable, often federal or tribal land. Delays apparently every year or many years in the funding, and a lot of uncertainty this year after the shutdown and changes in the Federal Education Department. Josh, this year is unusual, again, with the shutdown. And then the Trump administration has been working closer and closer to major shakeups, closing down divisions in the Department of Education, relocating, they say, some of their efforts to the Department of Labor and elsewhere. Are you concerned that this will turn from a conversation about when this impact aid funding shows up this year to if this impact aid funding shows up this year?
I'm hopeful that won't be a conversation. I mean, I'm confident that we'll receive the money. It's, you know, the districts that receive impact aid dollars need in the impact that those monies to, you know, keep the doors open. So I don't see it. Nothing's been communicated at the national level that this money isn't going to come. Like I said, I kind of see it as more of a positive, because I think it's brought a lot more awareness to impact aid. It's a bipartisan issue. At least it should be a bipartisan issue. And the big thing for me is, you know, like I said earlier, it's never been 100% fully funded. And if we bring more awareness to it and we do get full funding, There are many school districts that I have to believe, have to short-term borrow every year just to make it through the school year. You know, we're lucky enough where we don't have to do that. But if we were 100% fully funded, we would, Lac des Flambeaux School District would receive an additional $2 million, which that's a lot of money. In a school district of 500, we could do some pretty neat things with that, and that'd have a lot of positive impacts on our students in this school district.
Beth, theoretically, as money could show up, as we're talking, or it could drag on for weeks or even months. When is a point where you start to say, okay, with this money not showing up, not yet, we have to, cut services, make significant changes in some way, reach out to, lenders or something like that? When is a decision time when this money doesn't show up?
We're already preparing for a greater delay. I do feel confident that the funds will arrive. So we already have in place short-term borrowing in the wings if we do need to pivot to that. The last thing I want to do is mid-school year start to lay off staff and really look at cutting our expenses in that severe way, because that would have a profound effect on our students and their learning this academic year.
Josh, both with the Lac des Flambeaux School District and the other district you work with the organization, is there a concern that if this drags on too long that they might have to do or consider doing what Beth just said, possibly laying off staff mid-school year?
We are not considering that at Lac des Flambeaux. I mean, we would have to potentially pull from our fund balance. We have some fund balance money that we would pull from. And like I said, I am confident that we will end up receiving the money. It just might take a little longer than in years past. But we've not had any conversation of layoffs or cuts or cutting to programs or services or anything like that. Like I said, we're confident that the money is going to come, and we're set up this year to make it through the year. If the money doesn't come till the very end, we just have to pull from the fund balance. We wouldn't do any short-term borrowing this year. If it were long-term after this year, then there would be that potential of short-term borrowing for next year, having that plan, have a plan in place for, making sure that everything is budgeted and paid for through that process.
Josh, I got to say, when we called the two of you up, I was thinking this is a story about the shutdown, which it partly is, and the Department of Education overhaul, which it partly is. But from what you said, the funding levels you've mentioned a couple times, but also just it seems like clarity and transparency here is a chronic problem going back through multiple presidential administrations. What would you want to see from whatever federal department ends up managing this when it comes to communication and reliability of this program for schools like yours?
Yeah, like I said, I think just the awareness of it, how we've been receiving money, I don't feel like is, how we've been receiving the impact aid money has any reflection on, the current administration or past administrations. We've received it the same way. It's been very inconsistent. And like I said, I hope I've received more calls and requests to have interviews because of, my role as the state representative for NAFIS with impact aid dollars. So I feel like it's generated a lot of concern, but also interest. And we've been able to educate more people on what impact aid, money is, why it impacts our school, how it impacts our school, how it's directly impacting our kids, why impact aid allows us to keep our doors open and our school functioning. I have a personal interest. I have two kids of my own that are in this school at Lac des Flambeaux School District that, would be impacted if something were to happen. And like I said, I'm confident nothing at the national level has been communicated to us that the money's going away. It was just the communication has been there's going to be a stall or a pause in, how and when that money's coming.
Beth, I got to ask, I know that a school district administrator has a lot to juggle. What would it mean to you if there was a system that said, hey, on August 15th, you're going to know how much money you're getting, and on October 13th, you're going to get the first installment of that money? Anything that would have that be reliable and that you can, bank on coming into a school year, what kind of peace of mind would that be for you?
Well, obviously, it'd be wonderful. That's typically the standard operating procedure that we're able to build our budgets around for other state and federal funding sources. In addition to bringing awareness to impact aid in general, I think one message that would be of great benefit, loud and clear, is that everybody sending word to at the federal level saying, hey, let's do better. Let's do better at creating a timeline. Let's do better, first of all, at funding impact aid at 100%. It's disappointing that year after year, the federal government is not prioritizing this funding at that capacity. We're talking about children. We're talking about the education of our children, and to wring our hands while we wait, not only for when it arrives, but then how much. It's telling our children that, sorry, you're not worth all of the funds that you should receive. And that's a difficult message. And it's certainly not a way we want to set our children up for success as they're making their way through our K-12 system here in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there. Beth, thanks for joining us today.
Miigwech, thank you.
And Josh, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time to interview.
Beth Papp is district administrator for the school district of Bayfield, and Josh Ernst is superintendent of the Lac des Flambeaux School District and is the Wisconsin chair for the National Association of Federally Impacted Schools.
Coming up, a Wisconsin author's debut novel tells the story of a unique disaster that starts in Door County.
What I really wanted to write most about is how individuals can live in times of crisis and have times of crisis actually be a catalyst for change, for internal transformation.
Meet the author of The Unmapping next on WPR News.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story to kick off gun deer season, which starts this weekend in Wisconsin.
As hunters flock to the woods for gun deer season, their days will be steeped in tradition and contemplation. For writer and forester Ron Weber, this time has always been about more than just the hunt. It's about appreciating the world and memories swirling around him.
As the sun inched up the horizon on the second morning of the gun deer season, I leaned back against a foot-thick white cedar, one of a clump of three on the edge of a mature aspen stand. The cedars offered me cover from keen-eyed deer and shelter from the light snow that had begun falling an hour or so before first light. I had first come this way in 1979 at the age of 15. The area had been clear-cut the previous year, and by the following summer, a sea of young, four-foot-tall aspen sprouts had colonized the cutover up to the edge of an expansive cedar swamp. Deer sign was abundant, so I searched for a likely spot to take up watch. The group of cedars seemed perfect, so I took a seat amongst them. It was impossible at 15 to realize how the aspen and the cedars would weave themselves into the fabric of my life. Over the years, I would return to this spot almost every season. I watched the aspens grow from wispy sprouts to 3-inch-thick saplings, 15 feet tall, in a decade. As the years passed, the aspens continued their fierce struggle to get taller than their neighbor, ensuring that they would get adequate light to live on another year. Sometime during the morning, it dawned on me that I had been sharing this view with the trees for 45 years now. Over the course of the next few hours, one memory after another played in my mind's eye. One stood out, though. It was Friday after Thanksgiving in 2002. Members of my deer camp had spread out in the area. I volunteered to mosey around in the cedar swamp to try and move a deer or two past my campmates. It was a glorious day for hunting. Blue skies, a 6-inch covering of snow, and temperatures in the 20s. After weaving my way through the swamp for an hour or so, a shot rang out. Eventually, I made my way out of the swamp and came upon my brother Gary. He was sure it was our brother Jim who had shot, so we made tracks to his stand, the clump of 3 cedars. There we found him with a beautiful 11-point buck. In a lifetime, some days are simply perfect, and that day certainly was. One wishes they could bottle such days, and things would always be just so. But it is a foolish wish, because life is far from perfect. So it was only a mere decade later that I returned to the cedar stand during deer season. Not to hunt, but instead to leave some of Jim's ashes there, where for a moment, life was perfect. A pileated woodpecker hammering away on a punky aspen brought me back to the present. As I scanned the woods, I realized this aspen stand was nearing 50 years old, the age at which aspen are routinely regenerated by clear cutting. How many more years would the aspens be here? How many more would I? Those are questions a 15-year-old does not bother to ask, but a 60-year-old does. The sun was gone now behind a gray veil of clouds, and dark would be here soon, bringing to an end another day. Standing up to leave, I ran my hand over the smooth, stringy bark of the cedar. They seemed the same as when I was 15. The aspen had grown up and older, as had I. But the cedar, with a lifespan of potentially 400 years or more, did not show it. Someday the aspen will be cut again, and a new sea of sprouts will take root for the cedars to watch over. If it can't be me to sit here in the clump of cedars, I could only hope some other young hunter finds their way here and senses how special this place is. Whether they realized it or not, they would be hunting on hallowed ground.
Writer Ron Weber is a forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News.
What if you woke up tomorrow and looked outside and realized your home wasn't where it was the night before?
That's the premise of the new novel, The Unmapping, by Wisconsin author Denise S. Robbins.
Starting in a small city in Door County, communities suddenly shuffled their geography, causing all kinds of problems. The strange event raises questions about the impact of disasters and how we deal with them.
Denise S. Robbins is a Madison author and a longtime climate advocate. The Unmapping is her debut novel. Denise, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get a taste of the book. There's this surreal disaster. This is not a spoiler. This happens really early in the book. What happens when my city experiences the unmapping?
So the unmapping is what happens when your city sort of gets sick and reacts very negatively. Every building rearranges with each other at 4 o'clock in the morning every single day. So you wake up one day on one side of the town and the next day on the next side of the town, and everything around you is completely not what it's supposed to be. You don't know how to get to the grocery store. You can't get gas. You can't get to work or get to school. And also, there are implications for electricity and water lines and all. It's basically a disaster story.
And it starts, a lot of the actions in New York City, but it starts in a strange community in Door County called, a fictional city called Gleamwood City. Tell us a little bit about this odd little place.
It is definitely an odd place. I invented the city named Gleamwood City in the tip of Door County outside Manitowoc. I was very inspired by Wisconsin's aluminum Christmas tree history in that location and rolled with that and created this community where they sprung up to create these trees. And then they turn into switching to fake trees that look real and aren't aluminum. Probably Charlie Brown was responsible for that at some point. But this is a very isolated, bizarre, almost too perfect kind of a place that is the beginning of something crazy. So the unmapping does begin there, but it's so small and kind of perfect, nobody really is bothered by it or really understands what's happening.
And you are from Wisconsin. Were you looking for a way to say, okay, Wisconsin has to be part of this wider story?
So I initially wrote this story to take place with a lot of different places all over the country, actually. In each chapter, we have our main story in New York City. Mm-hmm. We have these two characters, Esme and Arjun, that are collaborating with each other to try to find Esme's fiancé, but also working for the emergency management department to try to handle the city in disaster mode. But I have all these side stories in every single chapter. We get a piece into somebody else's head. And initially, I had these taking place in many different locations. And again, with this aluminum Christmas tree storyline in Wisconsin, that was a big part of it. Eventually, in revisions, I did move a lot of those storylines to New York City because I wanted these characters to interact with each other and feel more connected. But I couldn't move the aluminum Christmas tree industry, nor did I want to. I love Wisconsin, and I there's a big place in my heart for it. And I think even in a book that takes place in New York City, the literary capital of the world, like, Wisconsin has a place. I think Wisconsin is in some ways the heart of the country, and it often gets overlooked.
This is a surreal kind of disaster, this unmapping, but it has a lot of parallels, I think, with the way disasters happen. And one thing that struck me is the cascading impact. Well, these buildings move along. Well, what about the gas mains that go into the buildings and the water mains and the electricity? You look at the things we don't necessarily think of in that first instance of a disaster. What led you to pursue that?
So I wasn't actually thinking that much about climate change when I first started writing the story, but that ultimately made its way into the story. My work is in climate change and climate change advocacy, and I thought I was writing this as sort of an escape from that, just a surreal way of writing about people getting lost where they live. So this always was a surrealist story, like you mentioned, and it really is how climate change feels to me when I think about what I fear most, in that the unlikely is becoming more likely. And surrealist does take a feeling that exists and is real and heightens it until it's no longer real. So this is a very untrue phenomenon that gets at the heart of what I think climate change disasters have to bear.
Also, it struck me that, okay, your characters in the book are dealing with this new, confusing situation. The authorities don't know what's causing it yet or how to deal with it. It felt like there were some very strong parallels with the first month or two of COVID hitting the United States and people being, do I wash my veggies? Do I wear a mask or no? I'm waiting to find out these things. A lot of your characters in the book are trying to figure out, okay, what do I do on a daily basis here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. In some ways, this is a retelling of that. And I was writing a first and or second draft during COVID, and it was very informative to see society react to such a pervasive and new crisis. I think that without COVID, maybe it would have seemed unrealistic for this to happen and for people to still be able to get through their day and by working remotely and finding GPS markers without society completely breaking down. But that's what happened. We had to really find new ways of living right away, and it worked.
And I don't want people to come away with the impression, based on my last couple of questions, that this is a lesson, a policy statement about climate change or anything like that. You're writing about people dealing with a difficult situation and how they live their lives in this unusual position.
Yeah, you know, I think what I really wanted to write most about is how individuals can live in times of crisis and have times of crisis actually be a catalyst for change, for internal transformation. That doesn't always happen, but I think it is a really good opportunity when something terrible happens to take a look at your life and question things. That's what happened with some people when COVID happened. They had to take a step back and think, what actually really matters to me right now? Not, you know, all the things that I used to take for granted, I have to throw them out and sort of rebuild what matters from scratch.
Talking to Denise S. Robbins, a Wisconsin author, about her new novel. It's called The Unmapping. Denise, you're from Wisconsin, as we've mentioned, and you worked out east for a while, and you came back to Wisconsin. What brought you back to the state?
Oh, it's just so perfect. I love Wisconsin. I love living here. It's funny. I think I so didn't want to move back here for so long because it just seemed too perfect. I don't know. It's like something I had to mentally push back on. And I always like to do, you know, the opposite of what is expected of me, or at least I used to. And I would visit home. But eventually what the real impetus was, I was living in Washington, D.C., and my husband and I wanted to buy a house and be near family. And so we thought that was much more reasonable to do here than over there.
Well, and I think a lot of times an author or someone in the entertainment or industry or whatever leaves Wisconsin to go to a coast because that's where you have to go to make it. You wrote a lot of your book while you were living on the East Coast, if I have the timeline right. Do you think that Wisconsin can be a successful place to be an author and to connect with the rest of the world without being in New York or D.C.?
Absolutely, especially the more online things get. I'm able to, in fact, living in Wisconsin, I feel like I have a calmer pace of life and I have more opportunities to connect with writers from all over the country, all over the world even. I feel much more connected to the national literary community than I was when I was in D.C. because I just have more time for it.
We've got a great bunch of Wisconsin fiction authors that we've talked to here on the show. Do you feel a connection with them? Do you have a group of peer writers, whether you are in touch with them or just read their stuff from afar?
I do. I think the nice thing about Madison also is its relative small size means it's pretty easy to meet the other writers in town. And so I feel like I've gotten to know them, not necessarily every writer, but a lot of great writers in the community and, you know, being invited to help out with the Wisconsin Book Festival and things like that. And of course, even the non-published authors, there are tons of people who are really interested in writing. So in a wonderful writing group, and it's really easy to find people who are really actively engaged. Being near the university, of course, is a big, big benefit, especially one with such a great writing program. But a lot of people I met aren't necessarily affiliated with that either.
You've written shorter works. This is your debut novel. Do you have thoughts of another novel, maybe in the works or in the future?
Oh, do I? I have too many thoughts. I have a couple of draft novels that are actually done, and I'm working on another one right now. It's just, you know, the publishing industry is slow, but hopefully there will be much more from me. I'm not planning to slow down anytime soon.
Would we ever go back to Gleamwood City? Because I left the book hungry for knowing more about this very strange place in the middle of Wisconsin.
So I actually wrote a lot more about this strange place than ended up in the book. I needed to really work out in my head what was happening. So I wrote pages and pages and pages. And I didn't want this storyline to really weigh down the book too much. It's meant to be kind of a side piece of just, you know, crisis happens. Some people are going to go a little crazy, and that was an important thing to include. But I don't think I'm planning to return there anytime soon, but I'm not totally ruling it out.
Denise, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Wisconsin author Denise S. Robbins. We've been talking about her new novel. It's called The Unmapping.
It is that time of the football season when the Packers host the Vikings and the rivalry takes over our Sunday. And we want to know, what snacks will you be serving for the game?
Do you have special game day food? What do you serve to your guests, or what do you bring if you are the guest?
And if you are full on tailgating on Sunday, what's on the menu?
Share your game day favorite foods. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call us or text us. Either way, the number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Go Pack.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox and Trevor Hook.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Tim Peterson is our managing producer, and Dean Knetter is our executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.